All right. Okay. So I'm going to talk about axions, the past, the present, and the future. In fact, when Maxime asked me to give a sort of a review talk about this, I felt a little depressed, since I feel like reviews are often given by old people. And I felt this was a kind of indication from Maxime that I was getting old. Anyway, so I'll talk about some of the past work, but also towards the end, I'll discuss more sort of future things, sort of new ideas in the field. You know, we're here because we want to search for new physics. But how do you find new physics? You don't quite know where it is. You got to pretty much figure out where to look in this vast array of possibilities. And a reasonable direction, maybe, you know, that you want to go after physics that is some kind of solution to some very annoying problem. So this would be like supersymmetry, right? The hierarchy problem is a very irritating problem, and you come up with a new solution for it, and then you try to find particles that are associated with that. So that's one direction possible. Another thing would be a generic expectation of fundamental theory. You know, there's some theory that you really like to believe, and it gives rise to some generic features that you want to go after. The decay of the proton is one such example. If you look at most of our theories of fundamental physics, it typically ends up violating baryon number. So you want to go and look for proton decay. In fact, in that case, you know at some level baryon number was violated because we exist today. Right? That's additional kind of thing. And ideally, it's better if you actually have this stuff that you're doing is a new solution to other problems, right? That whatever solves this problem automatically solves some other problems that you worry about. That would be really good. And axions are really kind of good in that sense because they actually satisfy all three criteria. They were initially introduced to solve something called the strong CP problem. They very naturally flow out of UV theory because, you know, they're kind of Goldstone bosons or broken symmetries, and they can usually be dark matter, right? So it's a very kind of a pretty framework. That's why I think it's very good to go after it. So in that sense, I'll talk about essentially two aspects of the story. There's the theory and the experiment. On the theory side, I'll basically talk about where the axions come from, what are their constraints, etc. And then I'll discuss some new possibilities, essentially on some of the new constraints that have been placed on axion parameter space. After that, I'll talk about experiments, but I'll review current approaches and then talk about new possibilities, new ways to probe axion parameter space. Okay. So what are axions? All you need to have is to say the first line on that slide, which is that there is some global symmetry somewhere that's broken at some very high scale FA. Once you make those statements, there will be a light Goldstone boson that the theory automatically gives you. And it can couple to the standard model in these very well-defined ways. It can couple to Gauge fields through operators of this form. This is the field strength of QCD, field strength of electromagnetism, and to nucleons through that kind of operator. Okay, and also, all of the interactions of the axion will be suppressed by the scale F. Okay, that's what theory gives you very, very easily. We have no idea what these scales really are, and that's why we try to probe this. Of the many different kinds of axions possible, because, in fact, it's very easy to get them, right? All you have to do is just break that global symmetry. There's one axion that will couple to QCD. There's one linear combination that couples to QCD, and that guy gets a special name. He's called the QCD axion. And that's because of the fact that QCD ends up giving him special properties, constraints, things like that. So he gets a special name. There are other axion-like particles possible that couple to these things, the other orthogonal linear combinations, if you will. And they kind of go by the somewhat stupid name of axion-like particles. But really, you know, they're just as motivated, if you will, as any other light Goldstone boson in the theory. And this is a very generic way in which you can actually couple to ultraviolet symmetries, right? I mean, this is what, you know, this is in fact the strongest operator with which standard model will interact with these global symmetries that are broken at high scale. So this is why it's such a good thing to search for, because it's an incredibly reasonable thing to be true. All right, so let's talk about the QCD axion briefly. What you really need to know for this audience is really that QCD gives it extra properties, okay? Some non-perturbative effects from QCD. It stops making it a pure Goldstone boson, and that can therefore give rise to a couple of scalar interactions. In particular, it gives it a mass. And the mass goes proportional to the QCD scale squared over this parameter FA, which we don't quite know. So if you take F to be somewhat large, let's say the gut scale or something, that gives you a mass that is ordered about a megahertz. Okay? And that's very interesting, because even though the QCD axion comes from really ultra-high energy physics, you know, the QCD scale, gut scale, stuff like that, the mass it gives you is in the range of, say, kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, that range. And those are like lab-accessible length scales. Right? And that means that you actually get a variety of experimental probes that are possible to go after these particles. Okay, this particle was introduced to solve the so-called strong CP problem, which is this claim that if you look at the QCD Lagrangian, I can put down this parameter theta GG dual that exists over there. And if it existed, it would give rise to a nucleon EDM that is order 10 to the minus 16 times theta. And from experiments, we know that theta is about less than 10 to the minus 9 today. And that sort of raises one of these annoying problems in particle physics where we say we look at a small number and we ask, why is it small, right? And the axion is a very simple solution to this problem. Basically, if the axion exists, if the QCD axion exists, it'll couple to this operator, you know, exactly the same form as that operator, as you can see from there. And once it acquires a mass, the axion field will basically roll down to its minimum. And that happens to be the same minimum which minimizes this parameter. And basically, that sets that to zero, right? So it's a very elegant solution to this annoying problem. The same mechanism automatically generates a dark matter abundance for the axion, because in the early universe, there is no particular reason why this field would exactly be at its minimum. So in general, the field will be displaced from its minimum, which will mean that once the axion gets a mass, it'll start oscillating. And as it oscillates back and forth, those oscillations carry energy density. And you can show that it is that this energy density behaves exactly like cold dark matter. There are other ways, in fact, where you can produce axions. They come from like cosmic strings, et cetera. And in some parts of parameter space, they can even dominate over this mechanism. But in general, the bottom line is that the QCD axion is a very easy thing to get from theory. If it exists, it'll quite easily also solve the strong CP problem and very reasonably becomes the dark matter of the universe. Axion-like particles, the game here is much more open. They don't get a mass from anything that we know about, right? The standard model by itself, these operators don't have these sort of non-perturbative effects that QCD has to give a mass to the axion, to these axion-like particles. But it's reasonable that these particles also get a mass from something else in the ultraviolet, things that we don't quite know about. But that basically makes it very model dependent. The range of masses could be anywhere from being practically zero to being really, really heavy, okay? So therefore, these can be probed in a variety of ways, cosmological, astrophysical, and laboratory probes. So here I would say basically that it's easy to get this once again. All you need is some Goldstone boson somewhere, and it can easily be the dark matter, simply because there is no reason why the field would be at its minimum when the universe started off. With that preamble, let me talk about theories and constraints on this parameter space. There are essentially two kinds of constraints. The first are constraints that are based upon low energy measured parameters, right? These are things that we actually know to be true. And these are hard to evade. You kind of have to be a crazy person to try to beat these. The second are bounds that are placed often based upon assumptions about unknown physics. And those may not always hold. That depends upon your philosophical views of the world. I take the point of view that you should go and measure and then learn your philosophy that way. So let's look at the rigorous constraints. Of course, all of the interactions of the axion are given by these, basically, right? All suppressed by this high-scale FA. The basic idea of these bounds comes from the following. These light particles can be produced in some star, right, in some stellar environment, they will therefore affect the measured properties of the star. Okay. Of course, this bound then depends upon two parameters. It depends upon the interaction strength and the mass, right? Because if the mass was too high, then these things will not be produced in the star. Now, for the QCD axion, the mass is basically set by QCD, right, and the scale FA. So that's the only parameter. It's a one-dimensional parameter space. That's really all you need to know. But a general axion-like particle, we don't know what the mass is, so it's a 2D parameter space. It depends on both the mass and this parameter FA. So the dominant stellar constraints actually come from supernova 1987A. Okay, like that thing went off, and we saw neutrinos from it. And they were observed in Kamiokande 2. And basically, we measured the burst duration and the number of events that were seen. So if you had axions that coupled sufficiently strongly, they would affect the total burst duration or give you too many events. Right? And the fact that we didn't see those gives you a constraint on axion parameter space. The second are observations of what are called horizontal branch stars. So these are stars that are basically burning helium. And if you're producing axions also, that causes the star to cool too quickly. And that'll mean it'll consume its fuel more rapidly, and the lifetime of the star would be small, would be shorter. Okay. So those are basically the dominant bounds. And they essentially rule out axions with mass less than about 60 MeV, with FA below 10 to the 9 GeV. Okay, that's kind of the rough game there. There are actually slightly stronger constraints on this on very light axions from the absence of gamma rays from the supernova 1987A. And there the point is that those axions can be produced from the supernova. They'll be like high energy 60 MeV thingies. They'll sort of get out of the star. And somewhere between the star and us, they'll convert in the interplanetary magnetic field and become photons. and we didn't see those, so that also gives a bound, but that's relevant for really, really light mass axions, where that conversion is actually efficient.
Wait, I'm a little bit confused. So you are saying that, I mean, the first statement is the mass should be less than 60 MeV, but the next statement is actually below that, right? So
this is for...
different type of axions? Or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
You're saying that if the mass is
below 10 to the 9, then it's constrained.
Some additional sensitivity.
That's right.
There is mass and the coupling that is...
No, if its mass is greater than 60 MeV, you will not rule it out. Right? It's too heavy to be produced.
But if it only rules out F less than 10 to the 9, that allows you to have masses lighter than
mass. If mass is lighter than 60 MeV and F is larger than 10 to the 9 GeV, you're fine. So let's look at cosmological constraints. These are not as rigorous. They depend on assumptions about unknown physics and unknown cosmology. And this is how the bounds basically work, right? Axions can be dark matter really, really easily. And if something can be dark matter that easily, then you may screw up. You may either produce too much dark matter, or you may not get the right kind of dark matter. Your dark matter density may be too fluctuated. We kind of know, as Mark was saying earlier, that the if you look at the CMB, the density of dark matter is pretty uniform. That's 1 power 10 to the 5, right? If you screw that up, it will be ruled out. But the reason why these are not as rigorous is because this depends upon the production and evolution of the axion field, and that can go to very, very high scales. And these are scales so high that we've never probed them anywhere, either cosmologically or in a collider. So there are two tenets of axion cosmology, two things you have to know to understand how these bounds evolve. So the first fact is, if you take the early universe, right, there is some field has an initial value, it's got a mass, and there's a Hubble scale. If the mass is smaller than Hubble, the field will remain constant as the universe expands. It will basically retain its energy density. If the mass is larger than Hubble, the field will start oscillating, its amplitudes will decrease, and the energy density will decrease like matter. That's really all you need to know. And for axion-like particles, the masses can be very strongly temperature dependent. This is in fact true for the QCD axion, where the mass only turns on below the QCD scale, above that it's zero. So the bottom line is this, right? If this mass was on earlier, there'll be more damping, and there'll be fewer overproduction issues, okay? So it all depends upon when this mass turns on, how long it turns on, where it exists, so on and so forth. So let's first address the QCD axion overproduction bound. Here, basically, the point is this. In the early universe, the field has some initial value, A sub I, right? And for the QCD axion, this is specific to the QCD axion, the mass only turns on around the QCD scale. And the rate at which it turns on depends upon both the QCD scale and this parameter FA. Then you can do a calculation to see, how quickly does this mass have to damp down for it not to be too much dark matter today. And that basically places this one particular bound on a combination of the initial value of the field and FA, and basically says that this combination has to be about 10 to the minus 3.5, a somewhat small number. Okay, and that's true for all axions, for all QCD axions, no matter what FA it is, there's a particular thing. For a long time, this has led people in the community to argue that this meant that somehow you knew that the initial value of the field had to be order 1, and therefore F over M Planck had to be 10 to the minus 7. That was supposed to be natural. But in my opinion, that's a little too quick. There's no particular reason why the initial field angle could not have been slightly smaller, say 10 to the minus 2, which makes F over M Planck 10 to the minus 3. So if you talk to particle physicists, they would say, it's more reasonable that F over M Planck is a large ratio, because that's kind of a hierarchy problem in that sense. So I take the point of view that we have no idea which of these is more natural. In fact, we don't have a lot of evidence that the world is all that natural. So we should really go look for it experimentally and figure out what's going on. So from this kind of cosmology bound, essentially all ranges of axions, in my opinion, are perfectly reasonable. And if you look at axion-like particles, things that are not associated with QCD, the bound is even weaker because the mass storage is completely undetermined. Okay. The second is an issue that's come up more recently, which is bounds on axions from the CMB. This is from Bicep. It would be amazing if Bicep is true, because as Mark was saying, it really tells you that inflation occurred, and it occurred at a really high scale, very close to the gut scale, with a very large Hubble constant. The bottom line here is basically, so if inflation occurred, right, there are sort of two possibilities. The symmetry that's responsible for the axion, this parameter FA, that could be broken after inflation. So that's probably the canonical axion window that many people talk about, F below, you know, 10 to the 12 GeV, something like that. Now, if you write down a typical model, okay, what that will do is it'll give you topological defects, a variety of things like that, that we don't quite see. And you would say that's constrained by observations. And this is exactly what experiments like ADMX are looking for axions. But does that mean that they're ruled out? No. It just means that the simple model that you wrote down is not true. That you change the model slightly, these things go away, everything is fine. So that's why you build experiments to do that. Similarly, if the symmetry was broken before inflation, right, there are additional problems, which is that the inflation can induce what are called isocurvature perturbations of the axion field. And that will mess up the CMB. We don't quite see that. Okay. Now, this turns out to be not such a big constraint on axion-like particles because they don't have an this history with QCD specifically. But it is kind of a constraint for the QCD axion. So if you take the simplest cosmological history of the QCD axion, or I wouldn't say simple, the most naive cosmological history of the QCD axion, then like this would be a very serious constraint. In fact, it would rule out a bunch of the parameter space, as we heard yesterday. But this bound does require that you have to know the physics all the way up to the gut scale, right? You really have to know the cosmology of the axion from the QCD scale till the gut scale, which is an extrapolation by over 17 orders of magnitude. And a lot goes on in the world, can go on in the world in 17 orders of magnitude. So what would you need, right? If suppose a QCD axion actually existed somewhere in the range that were supposedly ruled out, what does that really mean from the model building point of view? What does the models have to be? So really, what you need from the effective field theory point of view is to just say that there is a high temperature transient mass for the axion that needs to be on sometime before the QCD phase transition. There's a widely held misconception in the community that this needs to be a mass that needs to be on during inflation. That's actually too extreme. It is true that if the mass is too big during inflation, this problem would not occur. But really, as long as it's on any time between between QCD till the inflation scale, any time during that very vast window, the following stuff will happen. Basically, once that mass is on, the field will start oscillating earlier, and it'll oscillate to some high temperature minimum wherever that mass picks it up. So the field will oscillate earlier, it'll settle down to a high temperature minimum. That will automatically remove all of these isocurvature perturbations, and the field will become very, very uniform. Okay? Now, there is no reason why this high temperature minimum needs to be the same as a low temperature minimum. In general, they're two completely uncoupled parameters, and that will essentially regenerate axion dark matter for you. Okay? So this is really all you require is to turn on this high temperature mass that is transient, because it needs to disappear. So you can say, well, how did you do that? Unfortunately not. I mean, it depends a bit on the mechanism, but it is very, very easy for this thing to be completely gone. Yes. So a specific mechanism would be this thermal monopole density that we can discuss if you want. That is something where your mass appears because there is a gas of monopoles and antimonopoles, and once the monopoles disappear, the mass goes out. No, so then you get into more model building kind of questions. So the way, here's a simple model, if you will, right? Assume there is some U1 prime that your axion couples to. There are magnetic monopoles under that U1 prime. All of this stuff happens, the field is oscillated down. Then somewhere below that, you break that U1 prime. The monopoles will confine, they'll annihilate and go away. Yeah. Yes?
So you said the high temperature matter can be different from the low temperature.
Yes. No. So the high temperature minimum, the low temperature minimum, they're two completely different parameters. The high temperature minimum is not even coming from QCD. It's coming from some other field. It's a totally different field, exactly, yeah. Okay. All right, so indeed, as Maxime asked, how do I pull that off? How do I get a high temperature transient mass? You know, there's some work in the literature about this, but you know, prior to BICEP, this was not a big field for people to invest their time in. But actually, as I mentioned, there's a beautiful paper by Preskill and Fischler back in 1983, published about 7 days before I was born, on this particular mechanism. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Okay. Now, therefore, I think the bottom line is this bound depends upon high energy physics. It depends upon what goes on, you know, from QCD till inflation, a big extrapolation in energies, and everything else we care about, the strong CP problem, axion dark matter, all of that stuff, it all relies upon low energy physics. So there's just a lot of freedom for you to play the, you know, change the story. So here's where I think the situation is right now. If you look at axions in general, their bounds can more or less be characterized by this parameter FA. If F is below 10 to the 9 GeV, you know, is solidly ruled out. Above that is basically open space. There are some model dependent bounds in this region, undoubtedly. Anywhere above 10 to the 11 GeV is where there can be dark matter. And it therefore creates a big, rather large unconstrained parameter space for QCD axions. And it would be, and of course, for axion-like particles, which have no history with QCD, these bounds are even more relaxed. So it's a good thing to go search for. And in much of this parameter space, it's the dark matter. So there are a couple of avenues of discovery here. The first idea would be to produce and detect the axion. That's something you could try to do in the laboratory. Or the other thing would be to go and detect axion dark matter in the cosmos. The advantage of producing and detecting in the lab is the fact that, you know, that's something you care about, the fact that this particle exists in the Lagrangian. It exists in the spectrum. You don't care about it being out in the cosmos. So that's obviously very good if that can be done. But obviously, there is no particular reason not to do the axion dark matter stuff, because it's very reasonable to have a large cosmic abundance of these axions. As I said, it's very easy to get them to be dark matter. The reason why you think about doing this is because most of the time, the cosmic density is often larger than what you can produce in the laboratory, right? And that's why that's also a good target to go after for axions. So let's review about experiments. I'll talk about traditional approaches first. This is a very popular one. Basically, they go by the name of light shining through a wall kind of experiments. They rely on the fact that axions couple to electromagnetism, A over F, roughly E dot B. And what this does is the following. If you have a photon and you have a magnetic field and there's an axion, the photon converts to an axion. Okay. So what you do is you take some light, you have some magnetic field, and you shine the light. The photon converts to an axion. The axion will go through the wall. The light will not. And then on the other side, you apply a magnetic field again and convert back to a photon. So if you see a light shining through a wall, you've seen an axion. Okay. That's one way to go after it. Very cute experiment. Second kind is stuff that we actually talked about yesterday to some extent, which are essentially, call it a force through a wall, through a shield. Much like a light through a wall, it's like a force through a shield. Here you could take some nucleons, right? They couple to axions through operators of this form. And this basically mediates a spin-spin force, like a new magnetic field, right? So what you would do is essentially take some sample of material, and there's a new magnetic field, this sort of axion-like field that goes through some shield, and then you try to see it on the other side. And sort of several people in this conference have worked on trying to search for such fields. The final kind is basically the sun shining through a wall. That is, you allow the Almighty to use the sun to produce axions for you. And these will go to, so these axions are coming towards you, and you build a big wall, and you block the sun, and the light comes in, and there's a big magnetic field. The sun and that will convert the axions back to photons, and that's something you can see. And the CAST experiment at CERN is aiming to go after those things. Then there are the searches for axion dark matter. This is basically relying on the fact that axions, of course, couple to electromagnetism. There's a reasonable coupling to have. So there's a cosmic axion background. There's a big magnetic field in some cavity. The axion comes in, converts to a photon, right? And that, again, is something you can see. And that's what ADMX is trying to go after right now. And that's a great idea. All right, so where are we in this big parameter space? Currently ADMX is probing stuff around here, right? There's a big parameter space up there that's currently unprobed, and there's also like much to be done in this region where people are obviously actively working on ideas. There's a large parameter space that still is quite unconstrained, and we need to beat small couplings. And that's the problem. If you want to go up in this region, you have to basically beat the small coupling in these things. Okay, new ideas. So I'm going to talk about two new ideas. One is based upon the idea that you can produce and detect axions as long as they exist in the Lagrangian. And that is something that was mentioned yesterday many times, which is the fact that they can cause what is called super radiance in astrophysical systems. The second is the possibility that if they're axion dark matter, you can use sort of NMR-style searches to search for them in experiments like CASPER. Okay. I think they're both very interesting directions to go forward. So let's first talk about super radiance. It needs to exist in extremal astrophysical systems. So here's the overview of how it works, and we'll get into the technology of how it works in the oncoming slides. The basic idea is this, okay? Super radiance is an incredibly efficient mechanism to remove angular momentum from extremal objects that are rotating if there happen to be light massive bosons, like axions that are coupled to the star, okay? So the point would be the fact that if you see such an extremal object, an object that's rotating really, really rapidly, then that fact would be inconsistent with there being these light bosons in the spectrum, okay? So the idea would then be that you go and search for such objects, and if you see them, you've ruled something out. Or if you sort of have a variety of searches that you have for these objects, and you find a statistically significant gap in the spectrum of such things, then maybe that they imply the existence of such particles. Mina and collaborators have actually worked on how to do this using black holes. It's a very good idea. And in fact, I'm currently working on topics where essentially this is such an the point is this is a very general instability, and one could go beyond black holes. One could also use millisecond pulsars to constrain these kinds of objects. Okay, so that's kind of the idea. You're basically looking for a very rapidly spinning object. If you see it, that tells you something about particles in the spectrum. If you don't see it, that's good. Okay, so what is super radiance really, right? So let's consider a case where, which is, you know, we're all very familiar with, which is, let's say I take a pulsar, right? I mean, and there's some magnetic field, and this magnetic field is not aligned in the direction of spinning of the pulsar. That gives rise to a time-varying magnetic dipole, and that gives rise to dipole radiation at frequencies omega. This is a typical Jackson problem. Now, you can ask the following question. What happens if the magnetic field is aligned with the rotation axis? In that case, there is no time-dependent magnetic field, right? So you would say no radiation. And you'd be correct at the leading order. So let's consider axisymmetric rotating objects. That's when this magnetic field is aligned.
But that comment, I mean, you have the wrong model for the pulsar. You have to account for the plasma surrounding. And even if it is aligned, you have radiation due to the interaction between the rotation.
I'm just telling you how to introduce super radiance. I'm not specifically getting into details of the pulsar.
Right, okay. But what you said was incorrect.
If you take like some object that is absolutely axisymmetric and it's spinning, there's no radiation. That's all.
If there is plasma, there is.
Fine. Okay. Okay. So why does this not happen? If I take an idealized object, not this particular plasma that the gentleman is pointing out, why does that not occur? Right. So the reason why that doesn't occur is because the radiated photon must carry angular momentum. Right. Now, for you to lose angular momentum, the photon has to carry angular momentum. And the problem is that this angular momentum cannot really couple to the axisymmetric star. There are no moments it can couple to. That's why the coupling vanishes, which is why there's no radiation. But if you think about it, this is kind of weird, right? This is a kinematically allowed process. I should be able to emit angular momentum and slow down. That should indeed be possible. And there are indeed these light degrees of freedom that are coupled to the star, okay? So you would think at some level, quantum mechanics at some level must give you radiation. Right, that's got to exist. And that's basically what super radiance is. And to understand it, let's look at a similar process, which is really absorption. So let's say I take an axisymmetric star, right? Okay, perfectly axisymmetric, and I throw a photon at it, right? And photon carries angular momentum. What happens? That photon will get absorbed in the star. And that absorption basically means that it'll, you know, create some eddy currents or whatever in the star, right? That's where this absorption really occurs. So basically, the fact that you have absorption means that you have a coupling between the rotation of the star and these other degrees of freedom. Okay, and of course the angular momentum simply gets sort of transferred into the stellar excitation. So that basically means that this matrix element is non-zero, right? My star can indeed couple to a photon with some angular momentum as long as it's possible for me to absorb. So therefore, this matrix element exists. And if you have a kinematics, and when the kinematics allows for this process, which is the inverse of, so super radiance in a sense is the inverse of absorption. So your star should be able to emit a photon and create some stellar excitation, right? It's the same matrix element that we talked about earlier for absorption. And this process will occur as long as it's kinematically allowed, okay? So you can go through the kinematic argument. You want your star to slow down a little bit and produce some stellar excitation and produce this photon. That basically means that you want that energy to be non-zero, and you go through some algebra and you see this condition here. That essentially if the angular momentum of the emitted photon is large enough and has a right sign, then you can slow down by creating acceleration excitation. Okay, so that's the basic idea. And of course, you can that makes it look like you can produce photons of arbitrarily high energy, right? But of course, that shouldn't happen. And real answer is the fact that modes of arbitrarily high angular momentum are far from the star. So they won't couple the same way, right? The coupling gets killed. And that's why it doesn't really happen. So if you want to think about it generally, the comparison between like multipole radiation and super radiance, multipole radiation, once you have a non-axis symmetric system, that'll happen. And the radiation will be at multiples of omega, the frequency. While super radiance is really a decay. It's an instability of any absorptive rotating system, okay? And it's continuum emission. I can produce an arbitrarily soft spectrum of photons possible, all right? Now, most of the time, absorption will be subdominant. So super radiance is usually subdominant to multiple radiation, okay? So you can ask, why would you ever care? What's the beef? Why is it ever interesting? It's interesting in one situation, which is if you have a massive particle, okay, that is coupled to the star, say gravitationally, for example, which it has to be. So if you have a particle of some mass mu, and there's a star of mass m, let's say, then this particle will have gravitational bound states around it, just quantum mechanically. Right, that'll just exist. And they'll be localized at some Bohr radius, which is 1 over gm mu squared. Okay. So now what happens? The super radiant process occurs. It'll basically pump particles into this these modes. Okay. And that basically gives you a laser. Right? There's a Bose enhancement from the fact that as these particles go and sit in there, they will drive this process more and more rapidly, sort of stimulated emission. Okay? So there's essentially like a gravitational laser, if you will, that's happening in the sky. And that leads to an exponential amplification of the rate. Okay, and therefore, this is an interesting thing, is that this could be efficient if these new light particles are coupled sufficiently strongly to the stellar medium, right? If you have enough absorption, if you can produce enough of these things, that could be an interesting way to find these, okay? And that's what leads to the idea that perhaps you can use sort of rotating black holes or pulsars, et cetera, to find these things, because these kind of situations are satisfied in stars. I have a big star, a big mass, I can easily bind things to it gravitationally, and then I can also absorb efficiently and superradiate easily. So if you want to see a little bit of the mathematics, I kind of don't want to get stuck on this. It's just basically telling you how the math sort of works. If I have a particle of mass psi, a particle psi of mass mu, and it interacts with the medium, right? This is the kind of equation that you write down that describes absorption. And you go to the rest frame, you basically see that the mode goes at e to the minus c over t. So if the c is positive, that's damping. If c happens to be negative, the mode will grow. Okay, that's just straightforward from that.
Should it be V effective prime?
V effective prime, yes. Sorry, yes. Okay, so now I should point out, given the large number of Russians in this audience, this was first figured out by Zeldovich back in 1967. So it's all true. We're only following what he's already done. It must be right. Exactly. 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 That's also true. I think it'd be a good exercise for me to go look up what Zeldovich has done and only talk about that. All right. So you can kind of look at this kind of. Your four velocity looks like that. Then you look at the equations of motion for the angular momentum modes, and yada, yada, yada. What you will see is that this gives an additional terms to C. Okay? So there you basically see that if m is big enough, then this parameter mu minus m omega will change sign, right? And that basically turns your absorption into emission. And this is the same kinematic condition that I sort of talked about earlier, where absorption allows you to do this. Okay? Okay, great. So now we see how super radiance occurs. Now, the crucial question is, where does the growth actually occur, right? For the growth to occur, it needs to happen at a place where this absorption exists. It doesn't happen in empty space. It happens where absorption exists. And the absorption occurs only inside the star. It can only occur where the star exists. That's where your absorptive material exists. And therefore, the rate depends upon the overlap of the mode with the stellar medium. And is therefore proportional to the probability of finding the particle in the star, right? That's what it is. So you can calculate that. You basically say that the modes are basically hydrogenic. They have some Bohr radius, so the gravitational Bohr radius, 1 over gm mu squared. You of course care about modes of angular momentum with non-zero L. So this is kind of how they kind of look like, okay, a small r, essentially. And so the growth rate kind of looks like this. Okay, it goes as gm mu squared r to l to the power of 2l plus 3. And remember, you require non-zero angular momentum for this process to make sense. So these are pretty high powers of this rate here, right? So this depends on pretty high powers of these parameters. It goes as, like, essentially, if l is 1, it goes as mu to the 10th, for example, g m to the 5th, et cetera. Rapid powers of these things. So we can ask, when is this process efficient? Okay, for what processes, what stars would they be useful, right? So that's the equation from the previous slide telling you how the growth rate looks like to that large power. And for super radians, you basically require this condition to be satisfied. Mu minus m omega needs to be less than 0. And that basically requires that the azimuthal quantum number L needs to be larger than or equal to that m. Okay, that's just the usual quantum mechanics statement. So now there are two issues. So if you consider particles of really low mass, right, it's very easy to satisfy this condition. The mass is very small, so even the lightest angular momentum modes will be super radiant. However, they will be localized very far from the star. They have very large Bohr radii, so you won't efficiently be able to populate them. Secondly, if you consider particles of very high mass, then only high angular momentum modes will be able to be super radiated. So those are far away, so they're large Bohr radii. Okay? And this is basically most efficient, therefore, when the rotation rate of the star is comparable to the mass of the particle. Okay? And now you can ask, what are the objects where this is most efficient? And this is most efficient, basically, if you can take the largest mass and the largest r possible, because all of that goes in the right direction of boosting your signal, right? The boosting the rate. Because a large r means that you have a bigger region to absorb in. Large mass means that you're bringing the Bohr radii closer and closer to you. Okay? But of course, you can't make omega and r uncoupled. The most they can ever be is omega r needs to be order 1, right? That's the bound from relativity. So given a mass mu, you essentially, if you want to constrain a particle of mass mu, then you essentially need to find an extremal object, an object that comes close to satisfying this condition at that frequency. That's what you need. And there are basically two kinds of such objects. There are sort of extremal curved black holes, and then millisecond pulsars, things that are rotating rapidly enough to do this. In fact, the fastest pulsars are about like 700 hertz or so. Okay. So this is kind of a very cool idea to go forward and do this. And here, if you will, are sort of the big two possibilities, the two objects that I talked about. The first would be like extremal black holes, right? Here, the absorption is provided by gravity. Gravity, you know, you absorb on the horizon, and that's where this kind of happens, really the ergo region. And for a millisecond pulsar, gravity doesn't give you absorption, right? It's too weak to do that in that case. However, your particle may couple to the star through sort of non-gravitational interactions. All of these axions couple to you through non-gravitational interactions, and that will be a good way for you to absorb and therefore get constrained. The field of black hole spin measurement is certainly an evolving field. Right now, it's sort of subject to astrophysical modeling. That's definitely a field where a lot of progress is possible and should definitely be pursued. And while, of course, for a millisecond pulsar, the spin and orbital issues are very well resolved. I mean, we know this. We see this in the sky. We know how rapidly they're actually spinning, right? So there's no doubt about those particular numbers. So for black holes, basically, if you had one clean measurement in one very clean system, you would be able to place very good bounds on these kinds of particles. While for sort of pulsars, essentially, they're good for bounds, for particles that are only coupled to sort of the number density, for like dark photons, things like that. But for axions, the bound will depend upon internal magnetic fields. So there are definitely bounds you can place. They don't quite constrain the QCD axion. They constrain axion-like particles. I'm happy to sort of talk about this offline with you. But that's kind of the story of where it is right now.
Charge, yes. It's a neutral medium.
Yeah, that's true. That's right, yeah.
So the observable here would be the spin rate, or you also think that you could affect the spin down rate?
Usually it's just the total spin, because this is an exponential process, right? So essentially, once you're slowing it down a little bit, you very rapidly slow the whole thing down.
So actually, I have a question. So
yeah.
When you talk about super radiance,
yes.
Do you mean amplified spontaneous emission, or is it?
Well, I would say stimulated emission is probably a better way of saying it.
Really, it's like basically a medium which is kind of has a population
version. Right.
And so it doesn't have like directionality. Is there a direction
Well, there's an angular momentum to it. So that is, becomes a direction, if you will. There are only certain modes that, are actually super radiant. So they will be spinning in a certain direction.
Do you mean that it becomes like a laser, mirrorless laser? Yes, that's what I mean.
But
so there should be like some sharp spectral lines emerging?
So well, there are only certain frequencies that are super radiant, right? So
what
you only produce...
What determines it?
Is basically this condition, mu minus m omega, this previous slide here. Right. So as long as so any mode that satisfies this condition will be super radiant. So that picks the angular frequency of the mode, if you will. Okay. So if m has a wrong sign, that won't happen. If m has a right sign and it's sufficiently big, it'll happen.
So what determines, for example, so there is a gain and there is a loss, right? So what's gain? I'm sorry.
Probably. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that particular.
Are you asking about what the rate is? What the rate of growth is?
That's it. So I'd like to understand what determines this, what's the physics of this condition.
So you can understand.
So this is the mass of the particle, right? And this is the this is the spin rate of the star, and this is the angular momentum of the mode that becomes super radiant. So any mode, so you know, if you quantize your particle around the star, right, there'll be various angular momentum modes, correct? And like some of them will have a certain value of m, and others will have another value of m. And the ones that have the right value of m will be super radiant.
Okay, let me exercise my powers as the chair here. I think this is a great thing to discuss in the evening as well, starting with you explaining the kindergarten level of
sure.
Professor Fine. In there how this works.
Good, okay. Yes.
And myself also.
The condition you can understand in the particle picture. Have a rotating cylinder, and you take a particle that's scattered tangentially from the cylinder. In order for it to come out with higher energy than what came in, with higher velocity, it has to be spinning at most with the angular velocity of the cylinder. This is what the condition says in the particle picture.
So anyway, let's discuss this offline later.
The evening, and because we just have maybe 5 minutes.
I have 10 minutes, I think. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Well,
but I started late, so I should get my full share. And this is actually even work with you. So the final part of this, since I have now been told I have 30 minutes to talk about this, so let me talk about the cosmic axion spin precession experiment, or CASPER. This is a new way to go after axion dark matter. So let me first convince you that if you want to go above this region of parameter space, above where this current sort of microwave cavities exist, you really want to think beyond axion electrodynamics, okay? And that is due to a couple of fundamental reasons. The first of which is that if you look at ADMX, what they're doing is basically converting an axion to a photon, right? They're making use of this particular coupling, A over F of dual, A over F E dot B or whatever. So there's a background magnetic field, axion comes in, becomes a photon. Great. And they are where they are. So let's try to go beyond where they are, right? So two problems. The first of which is that they're looking fundamentally at a cross-section, right? They're looking at an axion converting to a photon. And that basically means that all of their couplings are suppressed at 1 over F. They have to be. This is the story of the axion. So when you go from a matrix element to a cross-section, you're going to go as from 1 over F to 1 over F squared. So larger the value of F, you take a bit of a hit. There's a second very fundamental problem, which is that they're looking for a resonant conversion, so of the axion to a photon, right? So the size of the cavity that they're using needs to be resonantly matched with the size of the photon, with the mass of the axion that they're looking for. Now, that's totally fine when they're in this region, because this gives you sort of gigahertz cavities, things that people know to use very well understood. But as you go to larger values of F, or in particular lighter values of the axion mass, then the wavelengths of the axion gets very big. Right? They quickly become kilometers, hundreds of kilometers, and so on and so forth. And we really can't build cavities and operate them that are that big. So if you then have a cavity of fixed size, and you're trying to convert, do this resonant conversion, your conversion takes a big hit, right? Because your cavity is small. And that's actually fundamental to this operator. It's kind of a theory point, which is that If you look at this operator, and if A was a dead constant, then in QED, that's just a term which is E dot B with some coefficient. But in QED, the term E dot B has no physical effects. Okay, it's called what's called a topological term. It's got no effects. And so therefore, all physical effects of this operator are always suppressed by powers of the axion's Compton wavelength. That's just a requirement of quantum field theory. Okay, and that gives you an extra scale in the problem. And so something else needs to come in to swallow up that scale. And that is basically the size of the experiment. Right? So as long as you have a mismatch between the size of the experiment and the axion wavelength, there will be a suppression. Okay, and as you go to larger and larger values of f, that becomes a very difficult way to go forward. That then raises a very interesting question, which is how does one actually search for light axions? How does one actually do that? So here are the possibilities. We talked about ADMX right now is talking about axion couplings to photons. Axions can couple to the standard model through two other operators. Okay, and we're going to use those two other operators to go after this now. Okay, the first will search for the QCD axion, and the second operator is most relevant for axion-like particles. So let's focus on the QCD axion and see what one needs. So basically, here is the strong CP problem, right? That tells you that I have a coefficient which is theta GG dual that creates a nucleon EDN that is order 10 to the minus 16 times theta. So if you have an axion field that was sitting in the background of the universe, that would also give rise to a nucleon EDM that is order 10 to the minus 16 times A over F. That's just given to you by QCD, as long as the axion field is non-zero. How big is that EDM? You can do some algebra and equate the energy density in dark matter to the energy density like in the axions. And that gives you a value of A over F, which you calculate to be about 3 times 10 to the minus 19, which is independent of FA. Well, that's a very, very small value of the dipole moment. But importantly, if you can somehow get to it, it's very interesting because you're very independent of FA at that point. You're sensitive to a wide range of axions if you can get to that point. Why does that happen? It's because I'm basically surmounting the two of the problems that I had previously. Okay, the first of which is that I'm measuring directly the matrix element here. So this is a measurement of the dipole moment that directly measures this matrix element, right? So that's only suppressed by one power of F. The second point is that this is a non-derivative effect of the QCD axion. This is kind of this theory point. Even when theta is dead constant, GG dual gives rise to physical effects, unlike FF dual for electromagnetism, right? That means I'm no longer suppressed by powers of the axion wavelength, unlike the coupling to electromagnetism, okay? So these two things together mean that my dependence on F becomes very, very mild. Now, of course, this is a very, very small value of the EDM. However, this is not a static value of the EDM, and you typically look for searches for electric dipole moments. You're looking for values that remain constant in time, right? But this electric dipole moment will be oscillating back and forth. It's oscillating back and forth because it's proportional to the axion amplitude here, and that field is oscillating and with the frequency equal to the mass of the axion, and it's and this mass is something like megahertz to gigahertz, right? A very, very laboratory accessible frequency. And this basically means that you can think about new ways to search for this. For example, you can construct a resonance scheme to boost your signal. Also, it gives rise to new ways to actually fight it because things like systematics are a lot easier when you look for a AC effect rather than for a DC effect, right? Because this oscillating frequency is set by fundamental physics. It's not some parameter that you have in your Lagrangian. In your experiment. So here is just a cartoon scheme of how to do this. We can talk in detail if you want afterwards, or you can ask Dima really. So the idea is you take some spin, sample of material, you polarize all the spins, and you apply an electric field perpendicular to that spin direction. Okay. Now, if you don't have an axion, then sort of nothing happens, right? I basically go back to my previous picture. There's a bunch of spins and an electric field that is perpendicular to it. It's a null system. However, if I have the axion and it's existing in the background, each of these guys will pick up a small dipole moment. They'll be oscillating back and forth. And there's now an electric field that's perpendicular to those dipole moments. Okay, that'll basically cause the spins to precess. And as the spins precess, they'll basically pick a transverse magnetization, right? Because the spin is precessing in one direction. And that's something that you can measure with a precise magnetometer, like a squid. Okay, that's kind of the basic idea of the scheme. And you can see that there's a natural possibility of a resonant enhancement here, which comes from the fact that I can choose the Larmor precession frequency of the sample. And when that is equal to the frequency at which the EDM is oscillating back and forth, which is the frequency of the axion mass, then you get a resonant enhancement to the scheme. Okay. Of course, in the real world, we don't quite know where this resonance actually sits. We don't know the mass of the axion. So what you want to do is basically change the value of the external magnetic field and find one point where there's a big resonant enhancement. So
a strong magnetic field keeping the nuclei polarized?
You may need one to initially start with, but if it's cold enough, then the system will persist that way for a very long time without a strong magnetic field.
How do you estimate atomic EVM from theta term? This is like a horrendous problem.
Well, I looked at your paper.
No, we do the neutron EVM, right? Not the
atomic no, but there's
EVM create, I mean, the theta creates this, isospin singlet coupling, right? It's not known how, I mean, how it feeds into the shift moment, right? So
I'm sorry.
Calculations can be done. I'll actually talk about this today.
The nuclear level?
You express G0 bar, your ISO scale,
right,
in terms of theta bar. And these
calculations right, sure, are sure, right. So, well, the calculations I'm aware of predict a really tiny number for the shift.
You're talking about the shift suppression? Yeah, because
I mean,
in principle,
not just shift suppression. The question is the shift moment, you know, you can classify all this pion coupling into isospin, and so far people have been seeing effects mostly from G1, right? And this gives G0, right?
Yes.
And so the effects are, you know, very small. So I'm just wondering what you've been using.
I understand the question. So the question is, how does what's the atomic
dipole? There's a long chain of command, how this thing is pushed up into the
So what experimentally, what are you sensitive to? Are you sensitive to
sensitive to the
dipole moment or nuclear
dipole moment? Right, because we're really just measuring theta.
No, atomic dipole moment. I'm sorry.
No,
nuclear dipole moment, atomic dipole moment.
No, like there is some energy shift, right, that I that comes about when I place this thing in an electric field. So this is just like a static EDM experiment, right? There is some if I apply an electric field, there is a shift to this thing that comes from theta.
It's atomic dipole moment
that you're
but
whatever it is for static, that part is not
different.
Yeah. So this is the same thing. Yeah.
There is a huge problem for that particular calculation of atomic EDM from theta, right? I mean, maybe Evgeny will enlighten us today,
but that's what I'm using.
I remember this subject, right? It's been a horrendous problem.
Basically, I'm saying that if there is a value of theta, there is a certain value of the EDM, right? And this is what is bounded by all these experiments.
Right? But so
well,
far, specifically, left 07, we take the number from Sushkov senior calculations.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So this is basically where the parameter space then looks like. So here is the coefficient of this operator here, GD, right? That's the coefficient of the EDM operator. And to get the QCD axion prediction, you basically multiply it by the value of the axion field, and that gives you this prediction of where this line should be, subject to QCD uncertainties, of course. But that's kind of the estimate of where it is. Since I didn't get time to talk to you about phase one and phase two of this experiment, there are different levels of R&D that are necessary to achieve one or the other. And you basically see that phase two essentially would get you to the QCD axion over here. And I've actually plotted the mass in EV below, the frequency in Hertz at the top. There's a similar experiment you can do, which is searching for what's called the axion wind. There, we sort of rely on the coupling of axion-like particles to nucleons. So this operator, d mu a, n bar gamma mu gamma 5n. And if you sort of write this operator in the non-relativistic limit, you basically look at this operator of this form, right? There's a gradient of the axion field dotted in the spin of the nucleus, and that's something that you can actually search for. So if you have an axion in the galaxy, it'll generally have a gradient, there'll be some velocity to it, and therefore you can sort of process about the local velocity of the axion field. And if you look at it, this operator looks a lot like a time-varying magnetic field coupled to a spin, right? Because the axion field is oscillating back and forth, and that gives rise to some time-varying coupling, a velocity dot spin coupling. Okay. And since like you're not searching for an EDM, you can use a much wider variety of materials for this search, things like xenon, et cetera. And here's roughly a projection of where we will get to with like this kind of coupling. So this is this operator GA, d mu, n bar, gamma mu, gamma phi, n. And here is the mass in EV here, frequency in hertz at the top. And this is the parameter. Anywhere above this is basically ruled out right now from supernova, things like that. But there's a big parameter space out here that can be probed with sort of this kind of NMR technique that's out there. And if you look at it, this is what ADMX is right now. Right? They're a pretty high frequency, quite complementary to where we are. Okay, so I'll skip this. So this is pretty much the final slides over here. So the Casper sort of discovery potential, you know, everything is in terms of FA over here. And if F is below 10 to the 9, ruled out, above that is where it can be. And somewhere that can be dark matter. So these NMR style searches are most sort of useful in this high frequency window here, basically because if you want to go below this, it's hard for you to process at that high frequency, right? You require a background magnetic field. If the magnetic and you know, if you can't make more than a 10 Tesla magnetic field, you can't probe a very high frequency. Okay. So, but I think axion dark matter is very well motivated, so it's definitely worth pushing in this direction. So this is pretty much the final slide. Here's the parameter space again that I keep coming back to. There's sort of two directions. If you want to go high up, you want to, I think about ideas like Casper, super radiance, things like that. And if you want to go to the lower frequency window, then the higher frequency but lower FA window, then you want to think about ADMX, ADMX high frequency, spin-spin forces, so on and so forth. Thank you.